And I found that for me, the question of like really helped to draw out my shame, because it'd be like, oh yeah, God loves me, but he doesn't like me. He didn't delight in me. And I just remember reading John once where basically Jesus says, you know, look, as a father has loved me, so I love you. And I just was like so blown away by that. Like, whoa. As? As?
I'm Mike Wilkerson, founder of Redemption Group Network, and joining me today are Jane Grison, trainer and administrator for Redemption Group Network. Jane, glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
And Amanda Hightower, founder and executive director of REST, Real Escape from the Sex Trade. Amanda, thanks for being here today.
Sure thing.
And Daniel Teeter, president of Live at Peace Ministries. Glad to have you, Daniel.
Yep, good to be here, Mike.
Today, we're going to be learning more about Daniel. This is a bonus episode of Redemption Walk, an opportunity for you to meet the team, and today you will meet Daniel. But before we jump into hearing more about Daniel, for everyone, when you go out to eat, do you choose your favorite or do you try something new? Amanda?
I tend to stick with my favorite. I don't like to be disappointed with something new.
Which is, what is your favorite?
Well, it depends on the restaurant, of course.
It depends on the restaurant. Yeah. Come on now.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought this was like, when you go out to eat, do you choose your favorite restaurant or try a new restaurant? So you already assume that you're at the same restaurant every time.
No.
It's just a matter of where on the menu you're at. Is that what you're saying
to
me?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Depends on the restaurant. And if I know I love something already, I'm going to stick with that.
Mm-hmm.
Why take a risk?
Hopefully someone here likes to take risks and we'll find out. Jane, how about you?
Well, I always think about trying a new place, but usually end up at an old place that we've gone to before.
You're to restaurants.
Yes, to restaurants, not to menu items. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay, so you take the risk to think about other options.
Yes, I do.
All right. Daniel, how about you?
I only eat peanut butter and jelly, Mike, so I wouldn't. I'm kidding. No, but I'm with Amanda on this. I was thinking, when you go to a restaurant, what is it, the food you order, not necessarily the restaurant.
Telling.
So, yeah, it is. Very telling, Mike. I don't know what you tell by that, but sure, it's very telling. but yes, when I go out and order at a restaurant, it really depends. Like, so when I go to Indian food, I love tikka masala, chicken tikka masala, so I'm I'm going to focus in on that. But if I go to, I love trying new restaurants. It is one of my favorite things to do. I just like going out and seeing what's out there. And so, yeah, it's kind of a weird answer. I love to try new restaurants, but often I will try the same thing.
Right.
I would like to try more new restaurants, and I think I'm more inclined to do that than my wife, Tricia, is. But when we go out on a date and we're going to decide where we go to eat, it's become kind of an inside joke. How about we go eat Ethiopian? Because we only did that one time, and we've never gone back to Ethiopian, though I would like to try it again sometime. But we do have some of our favorite restaurants that we both like.
Best.
And so it's so easy to go back to the same. In fact, I had leftovers for lunch from one of our favorite restaurants that we had some takeout last night. So we do have a lot of the same favorite restaurants together. So that makes a nice date night, I guess, when we have the same favorites. But except if I am by myself, like if I'm doing a training in some other town or whatever, I'm usually looking for the best pho that they have in that city, which in some cities is... you know, is scraping the bottom. There's only one pho, you know. Once somebody told me they're going to take me to the best pho in Frisco, Texas.
And, hey!
And, yeah. So, anyway, for those of you who don't know what pho is, it's a delightful Vietnamese noodle soup. And we have it on every corner, it seems like, in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it is wonderful for all,
sure is.
For all the gray days that we have here. So... all right. Well, let's learn some more about Daniel, shall we? This will be a little bit free form, so I'll probably guide us through a handful of questions that we've talked about asking one another, but this is really for any of us. So Jane, Amanda, jump in anytime you want and just pepper Daniel with all the questions you always wanted to ask him.
Mm-hmm.
And we are recording, so he's... And I once heard him say that if he had to choose he would prefer to say everything that comes to his mind rather than to not speak. So this is our chance to ask him the questions.
Right. See what comes out.
Now we've
got you cornered.
Yeah.
It's true. But you also realize that I am in Skype, so I can literally turn my computer off immediately and escape you guys if I need to. Yeah, so just saying, if it gets too intense and too personal, I'm like, I can't do it. It's interesting. I just had a thought and it totally ADD'd right out of my brain. So I'm back, guys. I was going to say something.
And now
and
you know
gone.
Daniel.
And now you know me.
Now we're getting to meet you. Okay. Yeah. Daniel, what do you do besides podcasting?
Well, Mike, I currently am in the state of Missouri. I'm a licensed counselor here. Also am a certified Christian conciliator. So I do mediations and try to help people reconcile when they're experiencing conflict.
Okay, maybe you answered that question just now, but a conciliator is not a word I hear every day. So what does that mean to do conciliation?
I don't know, Mike, but I am certified to do it.
So everybody go to St. Louis to get the best conciliation you ever got.
Yep. It will be the best. I promise you that. And I'll give you a free coffee.
Okay.
No, so conciliation, basically, yeah, when you are in conflict and one of the options you do have is resolving that conflict in a way that is not adversarial, but mm-hmm. conciliatory. And hopefully it's being fueled by the gospel of reconciliation, mm-hmm. not just, hey, we want to resolve this issue, but we really want to seek each other's interests and we seek to mm-hmm. to pursue one another's hearts and stories mm-hmm. in the midst of the conflict because God has a plan for how mm-hmm. we resolve conflict. So that's what I kind of do with my day job, what I have been doing the last 7 years.
Well, hold on a second. I got one more question on that. I've heard of the book and read the book, The Peacemaker. So, mm-hmm. so something about peacemaking stuff, that sounds pretty similar to what you're talking about. Is it in the same neighborhood there?
It is, yeah. The Peacemaker by Ken Sandy is basically, I think he wrote it in the 70s, was kind of the initial resource content that launched mm-hmm. Peacemaker Ministries, who then started certifying people to do this work mm-hmm. Through the Institute of Christian Conciliation. And so they've been in existence probably 30 years or so. And mm-hmm. If anybody is interested in kind of a premiere on, hey, how do I resolve conflict biblically? Certainly check out the Peacemaker book by Ken Sandy or the new resource. I think Peacemaker's launching it soon, called mm-hmm. The Path of the Peacemaker.
Okay, and then I always introduce you as being president of Live at Peace Ministries. That's the organization that has something to do with conciliation, right?
Yep. Yeah, so we've got a team here of people, and we basically we do counseling and we do reconciliation services. So even this year, I've had the opportunity to serve church interventions, go into a church that was in conflict, and it was pretty intense. I've never had a church, I've never experienced booing during a church meeting, but that was the first booing.
Wow.
And anything kind of ranging from church conflict to marital conflict. And even within the last 3 years, I've seen a lot of abuse cases, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, marital abuse dynamics. And mm-hmm. I feel like God's taken me on a journey to learn better, sort of kind mm-hmm. of how to deal with this in the church. Mm-hmm. And so that's been kind of a journey I've been on the last 3 years, really. Mm-hmm. And it's been hard. I feel like I've learned a lot of lessons the hard way by making bad decisions or mm-hmm. poorly informed decisions that you didn't realize it at the time, mm-hmm. But then there had impact, mm-hmm. down the line.
Okay.
So yeah, in a nutshell where I'm at.
Okay. So we're asking, what do you do besides podcasting? And we got conciliation. Is there anything else you do besides podcasting?
Yeah. So there is, I actually within the last year have changed my focus a bit. God's opened up some funding and I have been starting to turn the corner to focus on more on research and writing the topic of how do we create and sustain gospel culture within churches and organizations that actually reflect relational dynamics that are healthy and are rooted in the gospel. There are so many gospel-less churches. I know that sounds really harsh to say it that way, yeah. But let me clarify.
Yeah.
Gospel-less churches in the sense of how we do our relationships.
Okay.
They've got a great explicit gospel message mm-hmm. on paper, doctrinal statements, everything that I would say I affirm, but in how the relationships are conducted and how they are done functionally, they are lacking those healthy relational dynamics that I think flow out of a grace attachment to Abba's love. Okay. And I would love to see us really live that out functionally and not just on paper.
So Daniel, you just said grace attachment to Abba's love. Could you unpack that a bit?
Yeah. So all relationships are built on attachment. And think about attachment as how we connect to each other. Mm-hmm. And there is a way in which we relate to others. We have a connection style. Mm-hmm. And I think that ultimately, secure attachment is formed and comes out of when we really know God's love for us, when we know our Father's love for us. And so when I use the word Abba, that's the word that Paul uses to describe this intimate daddy relationship of knowing the one-way love of God. Yeah. And so to the degree that we are able to be gripped in our hearts by his love for us, it enables us to move into the world and to connect with other people with confidence, with assurance, with boldness, and it's what the world needs.
So Daniel, I'm just curious, since you mentioned kind of gospel-less relationships in churches, if you were to walk into a church and just start getting to know people, like, how do you even assess that? Like, what kind of alerts you to, like, it seems like we've lost the gospel here in these relationships?
And that is the question that I'm trying to research. So what an amazing question. because that is what I'm trying to kind of make it clear and accessible for people. And I'll give you an example. I was raised in a fundamentalist cult. And I know this is a bit extreme, but for the first 20 years of my life, if you would have talked to me, I would have pointed to the Bible. I would have pointed to we didn't have a doctrinal statement of faith. We were beyond doctrinal statements. We were so Christian that we didn't have
you
a doctrinal
didn't even
statement.
Need
we,
that.
Literally, we would say the Bible is our doctrinal statement of faith. I'm just saying that's what we would say. And so the explicit theology would have been coherent. It would have been adhering to probably the Nicene Creed, historic Christian confessions. And yet it was in those implicit dynamics, those relational factors where fear and shame, particularly, would really be the things that were mostly impacting our relationships. And I'll give you more of a concrete example. We can profess and proclaim that Jesus, we are saved by grace, and yet we really are conditioned by shame in how we perform, and his love becomes conditional based on our performance. If I don't attend meetings, if I don't show up at the right time for the prayer meeting, there's kind of this sense of like, something's wrong with you. And it's so subtle and it's so powerful that those relational dynamics send a stronger message to our hearts than even the explicit ones that we, sometimes the explicit ones we send to people.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing your experience in this kind of growing up in the fundamentalist cult, like that is largely what's informing your desire to do this research and create change in churches. Is that?
Look at the smile.
Am I reading that right?
What does that mean?
It does indeed play a part in my journey and in my story. And it's been kind of I've come into this, even this last year, this recognition of those elements all being woven together in a tapestry that God is doing. And I remember sitting in seminary, it was 2008, in a class called Developing Healthy Congregational Culture by Dr. Peter Cha. And it was as if all of a sudden something in me just woke up. And I remember going, wait a minute, you mean to tell me that there is something that is more influential, more powerful than what we explicitly are proclaiming and teaching? And it's this thing called culture. It's this relational system. We have to do something about it. And I realize now that I'm reacting to something that was very personal. That was my reality. I lived in what I've described as the matrix, so to speak, this relational matrix of unhealthy, gospel-less relationships. And it has such a tremendous impact on the formation of my sense of identity and my beliefs. And I really hate walking into churches even today, working with people in conflict and seeing those gospel-less kinds of relational dynamics. And I want to make sure I clarify something, because that it can be a bit of an overstatement to say gospelist, and it almost make me sound like I'm dogmatically like going, oh, there's no gospel at all in any of these churches. So I want to be very careful how I say this. Think of it as a spectrum. Like in Galatians 2, the Apostle Paul confronts Peter and he says, your life is gospeling a different gospel, because he was separating and dividing himself out from other people, the Gentiles. And so Paul confronts him. He's like, your life is sending a message that doesn't cohere, and it's inconsistent with an identity that's shaped by God's love. Yeah. You need to change. And so I like to tell people, think about it like our relationships transmit a message. What's the message it's transmitting? Mm-hmm. Is it one of fear and shame, or is it what Jesus said, which is it's love and unity? The relational fruit that most will define his followers are love and unity. John 13, John 17. So now you got me preaching, and I'm going to back off a little bit.
That's good. Well, I feel like we're meeting Daniel.
By getting
you preaching.
You're getting some fire here. Oh, yes, yes.
Daniel, I'm curious how you got out of the cult that you said you were raised in.
Yeah, I'm still in it. Thanks for bringing up a sore spot.
I'm sorry.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. So that was 2003. It broke up. The main leader, as many unhealthy systems are too reliant on one primary charismatic leader. And when that leader was, it kind of came out, he was sleeping around and he was stealing money. It all just started falling apart. Now, there are still churches that are going, to my knowledge, that but a lot of them began to disband, a lot of them began to kind of fall apart. And so that was 2003. And if you want, there's actually a couple of resources out there if you want to get a little more into the details. GiveTachysAssembly.com it's basically the website that chronicles the church that I was a part of. It's got a lot of helpful resources actually on high demand churches and recovering from them. Mm-hmm. Another resource was the main leader. His granddaughter just recently wrote a book. It was published, I think, a year and a half, 2 years ago, called Girl at the End of the World. And it's a very, mm-hmm. very good book. I would highly recommend it. She's a very good writer and very good author. But she just expresses and articulates her journey out of fundamentalism and what that looked like. And so...
Are you saying she was part of the same cult?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Correct. Yeah. And then in chapter 11 of Churches That Spiritually Abuse, you can read about this, our church as well. So yeah, you've done something wrong when you've made the book.
Well, I don't know if I've heard that term before. Did you say high demand church?
Right.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so high demand means that there is often explicit and implicit demands made on your performance. And so there's a way in which the church leaders will expect a lot out of you, and you live and inhabit a culture that you feel the weight of that. And it's very oppressive. And so... There are, not only will that website give you resources of how do I heal from it, but it also will point to and gives you a full extensive history of the church that I was a part of. And, you know, it's really sad. One of the hardest and saddest things for me is watching people's vision of God get so deeply impacted and distorted mm-hmm. because of these kinds of toxic cultures. Mm-hmm. And it really, that was one of the hardest things when it did end, was watching relationships with people that I really did care about mm-hmm. transform and change in ways that I just didn't anticipate, didn't see coming. And it was really, really difficult, really hard. And I felt like people, I felt like my faith was in Jesus. And I'm not trying to be like, hey, I'm like so bad. I'm not trying to like put myself on a pedestal. But when it collapsed, I felt like I was like, okay, well, I'll go on to the next thing. Like, what's the next thing? But for a lot of people, a lot of my friends, something really broke inside of them, and in ways that I didn't understand. And I wish that if I could go back and do it differently, I wish I could have entered more into their experience. Yeah. I do feel like I was very, very self-righteous, and I do feel like I was very judgmental coming out of that. And so... Yeah, it was a mess. It was definitely a mess. And yeah.
You talked earlier about how, I think you said that in a healthy church environment, it's not going to be dominated by fear and shame. Maybe it was when you were talking about the grace attachment language and being connected. But I guess I'm thinking there's probably people out there listening that for them, church just necessarily means fear and shame and kind of authoritarian and, you know, making your conscience feel guilty all the time and maybe even the demand that you're talking about. And right. and it may seem like, well, that's what organized religion means. So how do you even know, Daniel, that there's an alternative to that where there's some kind of gracious connection there?
Yeah. Like, even the question makes me want to cry, honestly, because I do, if there are people listening that that's your experience, I believe it's your experience. And one of the greatest gifts you could, in some ways, God may want to give to you is for you just to slow down and actually listen to what is happening inside of your heart right now, even. If you feel the weight of the power dynamic, when you're in an oppressive system, you'll know it by the relational fruit. And if you're constantly walking on eggshells, constantly feeling anxious, constantly wondering if you've done enough, if you measure up, if you should or shouldn't, and you have all these should and shouldn'ts, right? Mm-hmm. Or if the leaders, the primary leaders, if you're going to be less than in some way in their eyesight, or if you're not going to be promoted to whatever leadership status position you would want to advance to, all of that can be evidence that something's really off. And Mike, your question, is it possible? Can there be this loving, gracious connection? You know, the really cool thing about being able to do what I do currently as a counselor and also as a conciliator is being able to see love-based relational connection get reestablished. And it's actually probably one of the things why I've gravitated to where I'm at. Watching and being able to give people what's called corrective emotional experiences, which I think the church should be. I know that's technical language, and let me just clarify that. It just means this. When you feel sad, instead of someone invalidating that and like saying, oh, you shouldn't feel sad, you sit with somebody and have somebody in a real live relationship go, yeah, that makes sense why that's sad. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that the brain comes alive when you have someone who's present with you, giving you an embodied experience of love. It literally will fire your brain up in ways that you never could even dream of, because your brain wires when it's connected to other human beings. And God's created us to thrive like that. And the church should ultimately be that, because we have the resource and we have the calling to be that kind of a community.
So why are we so often not that then?
Boy, that is another really good question. Let me throw out a couple of ideas. The first one is we have bought into some of the world's definitions of success and some of the cultural assumptions about what makes a church culture healthy have been straight borrowed from not what I would describe the gospel, but from more of a worldly perspective of success. For example, expansion-focused strategies versus faithfulness-focused strategies. Mm. If a church is more invested in expanding and growing and getting bigger, there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with that. But the top priority of kingdom growth is faithfulness. It's not expansion. And so there's ways of measuring, I think, in using the measuring stick of relationship, because at the end of the day, that's what we're going to be evaluated on. Loving God and loving others literally summarize the entire law, according to Jesus. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, he goes through every gift. He goes through, I mean, take the gift inventory, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, he goes, you could have everything. I mean, move a freaking mountain. Mm-hmm. I mean, burn your body for acts of service. Give all your money, and it means absolutely nothing, because the litmus test in God's kingdom is love. Mm-hmm. And so find love in relationship. See how love is actually coloring the relationships, if it's present, if it's not present. And love has a very concrete, tangible quality to it. And it leaves an imprint. You'll know when someone's in it for your good, and because you're flourishing.
So somehow you still believe that love and grace is possible in churches, though you've been burned so badly yourself.
Oh, that's, yes, I absolutely believe it. And because here's the crazy thing, God is committed to using the pieces that he has on the chessboard, mm-hmm. which includes every single broken church and system, and he will still work those systems and bring his righteousness to expression mm-hmm. as a gift, because that's who he is, and yeah. he's faithful to fulfill his covenant. And so there's a part of me that goes, all right, especially church conflict. I mean, it really sucks to watch the people of God go after each other mm-hmm. because it's so not what we're called to do. Yeah. And it's so painful. And yet the really interesting thing is, even me being on this podcast and talking to you all has been so shaped and formed by my upbringing and my calling, my sense of direction has been so shaped and formed by my experience that I see God not wasting that pain. Mm-hmm. I see God using it and sowing it in ways that can be redemptive, that can buy back the power of that suffering. Mm. I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah, that's good. Well, actually, you know what? All of that so far was just the first question. What do you do besides podcasting? the next question for you is, when you're not walking with us, who are you walking with?
Yeah. So I walk with my family. They're my wife. We actually have known each other since we were four. She was raised in the same church as I was. So she has got all the same similar experiences. You can't see my face, but we're twitching. So we've been married for 11 years, and we've got four kids, and we had the privilege of adopting our son this year, which has been an amazing journey. And we also have gone and we've been able to foster six other kids at different intervals of time. And that has been quite a journey as well. And I think even going back to the question about what does attachment mean, so much of my journey in the foster care adoption world has really awakened my understanding of how relationships function. And I've seen God really apply a lot of those principles to, I mean, just not only in me personally fostering and adopting, but in churches and in counseling, it all kind of weaves together. That's my family. They walk with me. Also there's a couple of guys that I meet with on a regular basis. Usually we were every week. Now it's every other week, 'cause we've, you know, all sorts of crazy life stuff, but we pray, we share kind of what's been going on in each other's lives. They know me, they know my struggles, they know what's going on. And if I'm up, if I'm down, I mean, they've walked with me the last, yeah, it's been like 7 years. And it's really, in fact, actually, we're all going to gather this Saturday and get and just kind of hang out and our families, and so that's really sweet. Mm-hmm. There's that, and then there's my house, my kind of my